LRS and Will Aitchison do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hey, folks. This is Will Aitchison. I'd like to welcome you to LRIS's First Thursday podcast. And we're recording this podcast for April of 2014. Can it possibly be April already? It seems like this year has gone by just in a flash. Well, we've got our usual potpourri of things to talk about, but quite a few of them concern the Fair Labor Standards Act. There seems to be renewed interest right now in federal courts in the FLSA. Employees in some cases are successful, particularly in one case involving the Los Angeles Fire Department, and in other cases, employees are not successful. Let's start with a basic principle, a principle that sometimes you just don't see as well understood as it should be. That principle is that the FLSA is not a panacea for what employees perceive to be workplace ills. The FLSA is very, very limited in scope. It's the country's minimum wage law. It is the lowest level of employment benefit that an employer can legally have in the country. And so the FLSA provides a baseline. It doesn't provide a comprehensive scheme of benefits dealing with wages and overtime and hours of work. Far from it. If you need that comprehensive scheme, if you want that, that's what a collective bargaining agreement is for. Rather, the FLSA sets the level below which an employer cannot go without violating the law. And that's what we need to keep in the back of our heads when we think of how the FLSA applies in a public safety workplace. And that principle is illustrated by a couple of the FLSA cases that I wanted to talk about today. The first one comes to us courtesy of the Missouri Department of Corrections. This is a case from late March of 2014, and it's a corrections officer who sues the state, saying that the state's flex time system violates the FLSA. Well, what's the state's flex time system? These corrections officers are potentially covered by Section 7K of the FLSA, so they can be treated on not a work week basis, but what's called a work period basis of anywhere from 7 to 28 days in length. And it appears, it's not completely clear from this opinion, but it appears these corrections officers were paid on a 28-day work period. What this corrections officer is alleging, James Norris, what Norris is saying is, here's what the state does. I'll work long hours on the first day of my 28-day period. Say I work 12 hours on the first day of the 28-day period. In fact, let's say I work 12 hours a day for the first week, so I've worked 60 hours. And then I keep marching through my 28 days, and the second week I work 40 hours, so now I have a total of 100 hours for the first 2 weeks of the 28-day work period. My third week, I work another 40 hours. That gets me to 140 hours. And then my fourth week, if I worked that 40 hours in that fourth week, I'd be up at 180 hours for the 28-day period. That would cost the state to have to pay me 9 hours of overtime because I'm over that 171-hour in a 28-day work period threshold. So what the state does is it tells me on my last work days, it tells me on my last Thursday of the month, this is a Monday through Friday, 8 hour a day employee. It tells me to go home an hour early, and it tells me to take all of Friday off. That way, I end up with precisely 171 hours in the 28-day period, and the state never has to pay me overtime. But Nora says, I don't want that. I don't want that flex time system. I count on predictability of work. And really what this does is to deprive me of overtime for that first work week when I work those long hours. And the federal court says nothing wrong with the employer's system. The court recounts what it is the FLSA does and what the FLSA doesn't do. The court says, look, the FLSA requires the employer to pay minimum wage and requires the employer to pay overtime once the employee has crossed the overtime threshold, but it is not a general set of rules for hours of work. And the court says, quoting here, the FLSA does not prevent employers from managing employee work schedules during the week to prevent the accrual of federal overtime. In other words, nothing wrong with the flex time system. If you work more than the overtime threshold, then the FLSA says you have to be paid overtime. But there's nothing in the FLSA that prevents an employer from flexing a schedule in the first place to avoid the payment of overtime. In our seminars, I sometimes give this example. Take someone who's not a Section 7K employee, but instead is a 40-hour-a-week employee. So let's say it's an administrative assistant who's not a sworn law enforcement officer or fire protection personnel. And this person, if they work more than 40 hours in a week under the FLSA, they have to get overtime. Well, let's say the employer compels the employee on Monday to work 20 hours and then compels the employer on Tuesday to work 20 hours. So they now have 40 hours at the start of their work week. Does the FLSA prohibit the employer from saying to the employee, take the rest of the week off without pay and not paying the employee any overtime for Monday or Tuesday? And in fact, the FLSA allows an employer to do precisely that. There's no problem under the FLSA with the employer changing work schedules to avoid the payment of overtime, and there's no daily overtime threshold. There's nothing in the FLSA that says if you work longer than your regularly scheduled shift, you get overtime. There's only weekly and work period overtime thresholds. Now, if you are in a collective bargaining state, and this Missouri case comes from a non-collective bargaining situation, well, then you've got the overlay of the entire collective bargaining process. Chances are you got a collective bargaining agreement that prohibits an employer from flexing time. Or if you don't have a collective bargaining agreement, it may well be that the obligation to collectively bargain over changes in wages, hours, and working conditions would prohibit the employer from imposing a flex time system. But in the absence of collective bargaining, this case and others stand for the proposition that the FLSA is just not going to get into the way of the employer taking actions to avoid the payment of overtime. And you've got this same sort of principle at work in a second case I want to talk about. This one comes out of Pennsylvania, and it too is a corrections case. These are corrections officers working for Butler County in Pennsylvania. And the question is, and they work kind of a complicated schedule, but the real question is the county required to pay these corrections employees overtime for their meal periods? So what are the conditions under which their meal periods are taken? The corrections officers are required to remain within the prison during their meal periods. They're required to remain in their uniforms, and their official status is that they are to remain on call so that they can respond to emergencies. And the county is not paying the corrections officers for these, at least a portion of these meal periods. And the corrections officers have more facts that they advance to the court. You know, they can't even go outside and smoke a cigarette, or they can't go to their cars in the parking lot. They are essentially confined to the prison. And the corrections officers say, hey, that's enough of a restriction on our activities during our meal periods that effectively we are working. And the federal court says, once again, no, employer is allowed to have this sort of system. Here, the question is, what's the legal standard that applies to these meal period cases? And we've seen a big evolution over the years of what that standard is. That standard used to be one that really favored employees. The question used to be that we would ask in these cases is the employee completely relieved of duty during the meal period? And if that was still the standard, these Pennsylvania corrections officers would probably win, right? Because they're not completely relieved of duty. They're told to remain in uniform. Their movements are restricted. If that was the standard, they probably win on their claim that these meal periods should be paid. But federal courts, about 15 years ago, started moving to a standard of who, the employer or the employee, who was the primary beneficiary of the meal period. Where did the primary benefit of the meal period flow? To the employer or to the employees? And that's the standard this court applies in Pennsylvania, and the court ends up concluding that the corrections officers failed to prove that the meal periods were for the primary benefit of the county. And here's the way this court analyzes the thing, and I'm going to read you about three or four lines here. The court says, although the confinement of corrections officers to the prison benefits the employer, it must predominantly benefit the employer for the meal periods to be paid time. This court finds that the corrections officer's mere physical confinement, parenthetically, I wonder how a judge would feel if they were confined to their work site. Would they then refer to that as mere physical confinement? Nonetheless, back to the judge's opinion, finds that the corrections officer's mere physical confinement to the prison doesn't rise to the level of predominantly being for the benefit of the employer. And the court says it's common sense. By keeping officers on call in uniform in close proximity to their gear, the county is able to include these corrections officers in the calculation of a safe inmate to corrections officer ratio. If a prison riot occurred while some corrections officers were in their meal periods, the meal period officers could dress quickly into their riot gear and assist their fellow officers. That largely benefits, the court says, those fellow officers, as well as the safety of the meal period officers. Therefore, the meal periods are for the primary benefit of the employees. Is this a good case? Is this good law? Well, there's cases going the other way on confinement of corrections officers. There's cases that do find that the meal periods are compensable. Those other cases tend to have a little bit more in the way of facts, corrections officers being restrained to a particular workstation, for example, or having their meal periods frequently interrupted. There was no evidence of either of those things in this particular case. This case is probably on the edge out there of cases that are leaning in the employer direction, but it's not so far out there that it's a complete anomaly. It's very tough to find paid meal periods under the FLSA. All right, third thing I want to talk about with the FLSA is a case that comes out in favor of employees, and this is a firefighter case, and this is a case that is very clearly going to involve very large damages once the case is done. And it comes down to whether or not the Fire Department of Los Angeles correctly interpreted the Section 7K exemption of the FLSA. And here's the issue. There's been a lot of debate over the years in the fire service as to whether people who are not line firefighters can be covered by the Section 7K exemption. Used to have a lot of litigation over whether paramedics were firefighters or whether they had to be treated as a 40-hour-a-week employee. And eventually, Congress stepped into the middle of all of these disputes and enacted a new section of the FLSA. It's called Section 203Y of the FLSA. And listen very carefully while I take apart this sentence that is Section 203Y, this sentence that tells us who is covered by the Section 7K exemption. So this 203Y says that an employee, including a firefighter, paramedic, EMT, rescue worker, ambulance personnel, or hazardous material worker, is a firefighter, is for purposes of Section 7K, if they are, one, trained in fire suppression, have the legal authority and responsibility to engage in fire suppression, and are employed by a fire department. And two, they have to actually be engaged in the prevention, control, or extinguishment of fires or response to emergency situations where life, property, or the environment is at risk. So a two-part test, and the firefighter has to meet both of them in order to be covered by the Section 7K exemption. Most of the action here is on the first of those requirements. That is, to be covered by the Section 7K exemption, you have to be trained in fire suppression, and you have to have the legal authority and responsibility to engage in fire suppression. That's where the action is, and that's what the debate was in the Los Angeles firefighter case. Two types of employees who are involved here. The first are dispatchers, and dispatchers in the fire department in Los Angeles work out of something called the Operations Control Division, which is in the basement of City Hall in Los Angeles. Dispatchers receive and dispatch emergency calls. Occasionally, they are sent to a scene to act as a liaison between an incident commander and dispatch central, and they'll track the incident, and they may on the scene dispatch further resources. They don't have any fire protective gear with them in their normal day-to-day work. They're not required to handle firefighting equipment. They don't go into the field to engage in fire or rescue operations. In fact, it's been at least 10 years since a dispatcher has actually worked at a fire scene. So that's one set of the employees in LAFD. The second one are what are known as aeromedical technicians. They work with the fire department's air operations unit, and they provide support, technical support for the mission. They typically have experience as both firefighters and paramedics, but they spend the majority of their flights administering medical care. They'll do such things as scene security, rescue operations, and they'll maintain the helicopter equipment. But what they don't do is fight fires. They don't wear the same gear as firefighters. They have different flight suits, fire retardant flight suits that they wear, and they are specifically not designed to fight fires. They will assist in the dropping of water if the ambulance helicopter is used to drop water. And of course, they'll provide all sorts of other types of technical support, filling the helicopter with water or fuel and those sorts of things. What happened in the case? The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, for kind of an unusual unanimous opinion, the Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit is often split on FLSA issues. The Ninth Circuit says these people are not covered by the Section 7K exemption. They're 40-hour-a-week employees. Why? What about dispatchers? Court says they don't have the responsibility for fire suppression. The court's phrasing is, the term most logically refers to those who are dispatched to the fire scene and actively engage the fire. These dispatchers working in the basement of City Hall don't suppress fires. They send firefighters to the scene to suppress fires. They're not even trained in fire suppression. Same with the aeromedical technicians, says the Ninth Circuit. Their duties consist mostly of medical duties, with the air ambulance being effectively a substitute for a road ambulance. Their other duties, assisting in technical matters such as loading hoses and fittings and filling helicopters with water, that's not the extinguishment of a fire. These technicians, in the words of the court, do none of the activities normally associated with suppressing a fire. So the court, Ninth Circuit, which is an appeals court, sends the case back down to the lower court for a calculation of damages. When I said this is going to be an expensive case, think about this for a moment. These are employees who have been treated on a 40-hour-a-week basis, on a Section 7K basis. That's the equivalent for fire protection of a 53-hour work week. This court has now said they need to be paid overtime when they work longer than 40 hours. And the decision of the court does not spell out what the work schedule is for these employees, but if they're even close to that 53-hour-a-week threshold under the Section 7K exemption, these employees could be due 13 hours of overtime every week. And because the Ninth Circuit found that the city's violation of the law was willful, could go back 3 years from the time they joined the lawsuit. This could be a very, very expensive case for the city of Los Angeles, and a case that will make a number of dispatchers and air medical technicians very, very happy. Okay, last FLSA issue I want to talk about is the Supreme Court is going to get involved in yet another FLSA issue. The court's been interested in these FLSA cases as of late. This one involves another one of these issues as to whether something that is done before the start of the workday or after the end of the workday, whether that something is work that has to be compensable under the FLSA. What's the something? The something is security screening. And these are workers who work for a subcontractor for Amazon, Amazon.com. The subcontractor name is Integrity Staffing Solutions. And what the employer requires these employees to do is to go through security screening at the end of their shift, or put it another way, after the end of their shift, because the employer is not compensating the employees for the time spent in security screening. And this case comes up from Arizona, comes up through the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals again, and the Ninth Circuit says, this is work. The purpose of security screening, particularly when security screening is at the end of the employee's work shift, the purpose of it is to prevent theft. That means that that's an activity that is designed for the employer's benefit. Or in the words of the FLSA, these are activities that are integral and indispensable to the principal duties of the employees. Therefore, the employees have to be paid for it. That Ninth Circuit decision was in conflict with the decisions of two other federal court of appeals, the Second Circuit that's up in the Northeast and the 11th Circuit that's down in the Southeast. Both of those courts said security screening is just simply not integral and indispensable to the employee's principal activities, and therefore is not compensable. The Supreme Court is now going to step in and resolve that dispute between the federal courts on this issue. I've got to confess, I'm not sure I understand how this old rule that an activity has to be integral and indispensable to the employee's primary activities to be compensable under the FLSA, I don't know how that applies in the modern workplace anymore. And I'm wondering whether the Supreme Court is thinking that, whether that's very much an outdated concept where we have all sorts of new ways of working, telecommuting, employees working, at a variety of different work sites that wouldn't have been possible in the past. And now such things as security screening and computer logins and logouts at the beginning and end of the shift. Isn't it time we had a standard that made a little bit, I think, more intuitive sense to employers and unions? And what would that standard be? To me, it would be, can the employee be disciplined for failing to engage in this task? If the answer to that question is yes, then the employer is using its authority as an employer to compel the employee to engage in an activity. That, it seems to me, should be compensable, rather than this integral and indispensable test that gets us into another test of what primary activities are. Why not just simply ask, hey, is the employer forcing the employee to do this, saying to the employee, do this or you'll be fired? If so, then the activity should be compensable. And if the employer doesn't want to pay the employee, then don't force the employee to do it. Will the Supreme Court end up with that sort of bright line test? Probably not, but who knows? The Supreme Court agreed to take this case in early March of 2014, meaning very, very likely we won't see a decision in this case until probably at the earliest, the end of the year, but maybe 2015. Well, there's our batch of FLSA cases for the month. Let's stay on federal statutes for a moment. I want to talk a little bit about issues that have come to us involving a couple of other federal statutes, the Family and Medical Leave Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. Let's talk FMLA first. This one comes to us, this isn't a court decision, but we have a Q&A section on our webpage that people send questions into periodically, and I take a shot at answering them. Of course, making clear that I say in my answer, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not giving legal advice, or I'm not your lawyer, I'm not giving legal advice. And don't rely on anything I say, check with a local attorney on this. But do my best to kind of point employers and employees in the direction they probably should be following. This question that came in was a very, very simple one. And I'll just read it to you. I strained my lower back. Can my department force me to use FMLA leave at the same time that I'm using sick leave? And we see this situation come up in a lot of different ways. Probably most poignantly, we see it come up where an employer is docking the employee's FMLA account, if you will. It's not really an account. Under the FMLA, employees get 12 weeks of leave. They have to get that leave from some account or another. 12 weeks of FMLA eligibility per year. So what the employer is doing is actually saying, okay, instead of 12 weeks, you now have 11.5 weeks or whatever, as the employee is using up the time. So we'll see this come up in a variety of different contexts. We'll see it where the employee may be on a workers' compensation injury, a pensionable injury. You know, may have gotten involved in a serious incident at work and has a back strain or whatever it might be. And while they're off on workers' compensation leave, the employer will be reducing the employee's FMLA eligibility. I saw it once very significantly in a case. This is involved a big city police department, and this is one I was personally involved in. I represented the union, and in this department we had an officer who was shot in the line of duty. He was shot in the leg. The officer was married to another officer who was pregnant. They were expecting the birth of their first child. The officer who was shot in the leg had a fairly lengthy recovery. It took him 10 weeks to recover. And when he came back to work, he got a letter from the employer that said something like this: welcome back to work. We know you are expecting to take 12 weeks of leave under the FMLA because of the birth of your child, and you can take FMLA leave for the time spent attendant to the birth or adoption of a child. We know you were expecting to take 12 weeks off, and we know you told us that was going to start approximately in a month and a half when your wife is due to give birth, but you just used up 10 weeks of your FMLA eligibility recovering from being shot. And so that means you only have 2 weeks of eligibility left. So tell us when you want to take those two weeks. And by the way, sorry about the being shot thing. Well, that is a case that eventually was solved politically. You can imagine that elected officials probably didn't have any idea that an officer shot in the line of duty was being charged FMLA leave for the time they were spending on pensionable status, recovering from their injuries. And the local elected officials passed an emergency ordinance that changed that practice. But what if the political solution wasn't there? And going back to the original question that we came in, if an employee suffers from a serious health condition such that the FMLA applies to their absence from work, can the employer designate the time off work as using up the employee's FMLA eligibility, even if the employee doesn't want that result? The answer is yes, the employer has that right. Under the FMLA, so long as the underlying condition qualifies for FMLA coverage, meaning it's a serious health condition, so long as it is, either the employer or the employee can designate the time off work as FMLA qualifying and thus use up the employee's FMLA eligibility period. If you want a different result on that, you're going to have to get it through the collective bargaining process, because the FMLA itself gives the employer the full right to charge absences from work due to serious health conditions against an employee's FMLA eligibility. Our next case is a difficult case under the Americans with Disabilities Act, or rather the Federal Rehabilitation Act. Same legal standards tend to apply. Even the court, and this is a federal court of appeals, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is primarily in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and in that area of the country, even the federal court of appeals says, boy, this is a tough case. And we kind of hate ruling against this employee, but there's really not much we can do. And this is a question of how, in a law enforcement context, employees who suffer from seizures, epileptic seizures, how they can be treated under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The employee here is a fellow named Emmett Coleman. He was a cadet in 2008 for the Pennsylvania State Police Department. Cadets have an 18-month probationary period. 6 months are spent at the academy, and then they have 12 months with an FTO, field training officer. 8 months into his field training officer process, Coleman gets involved in an off-duty car accident that's really serious. And he's left with a traumatic brain injury and multiple facial fractures. He took leave for a number of months, returned to work in a light duty capacity, and then eventually came back to work on full duty. However, while he's still in his probationary period, once he comes back to work, he suffers a seizure. And he gets put back onto limited duty status. His neurologist says he's got post-traumatic epilepsy and prescribed seizure medications. And despite the seizure medications, Coleman suffered two more seizures and a couple of what are known as seizure-like symptoms. The Pennsylvania State Police, PSP, they have a rule that says that any trooper who suffers from seizure disorders will not be permitted to perform full duty unless they remain seizure-free for 5 years. And that is a test, this 5-year test that the physician who, or the medical officer for the state police, a fellow named Michael Marone, he developed. He's a family practice physician, not a neurologist, but what he did was he did some research on his own on epilepsy recurrence and did some consultations with some specialists in the area. And what Marone concluded was that all of us in the general population, all of us have a risk of seizures of less than 2%. But if a person has recurrent seizures, the risk of another seizure is anywhere from 75 to 90%. And Marone's dividing line on this is that if you go seizure-free for 5 years, the evidence is that you are back down at the risk of the general population. In other words, you go from having a 75 to 90% chance of a seizure back down to having a 2% rate of a seizure. And Marone takes a look at Coleman's medical records and ends up saying he's had seizures, and if he's going to work, he's got to be on light duty. The troop's commanding officer says, love to have Coleman on light duty, and even writes that she could more than accommodate Trooper Coleman for 5 years, describes him as having excellent potential, and says that everyone who worked with him gave him glowing recommendations. Nonetheless, the State Patrol or State Police fired Coleman, terminated his probation, saying we, in this era of budgetary cuts, we can't have a practice of accommodating employees on long-term light duty assignments. Coleman sues, claiming a violation of the Rehabilitation Act's prohibitions on disability discrimination, and the Third Circuit rejects the lawsuit. And here's the rationale of the court. The court says, look, particularly in a law enforcement context, and an employer, a law enforcement employer, has to be able to ensure that officers are fit for duty. And that means not just that they can do the essential functions of the job, but the employer also has to consider whether an individual poses a direct threat to others because of their health condition. And the court says, looking at what the employer did here, seems reasonable. The employer had a doctor who did his own research, reviewed the research of others, ran it by specialists, came up with a reasonable judgment as to this 5-year seizure-free period, and that is a reasonable rule for an employer to have when you've got someone who's got life and death responsibilities like a law enforcement officer. The court ends up concluding at the end of the day, the employer has adequately explained that the threat of a seizure is significant enough to constitute a direct threat and that its seizure protocol is a justified response to that threat. Once again, it's probably going to be the same message on all of these federal statutes. These federal statutes, the FLSA, the FMLA, the ADA, just remember, they are the minimum levels required under federal law. You want something more than that, you need to bargain about it in the collective bargaining context, if you have collective bargaining. And these are topics, leave, accumulation of overtime, hours of work, these are topics that are very likely bargainable. Now let's talk about something that's not negotiable. And we'll go to Colorado for this. Until 2013, there was no statewide law in Colorado calling for collective bargaining for firefighters. A law was passed in 2013 that establishes sort of a meet and confer process for negotiations for Colorado firefighters. Doesn't apply to law enforcement officers. The police lobby, police union lobby in Colorado, not as effective as the firefighters union in convincing the legislature and particularly the governor, John Hickenlooper, of the need for collective bargaining. So we have this new law that will create this meet and confer system for negotiations in Colorado fire departments. But in the past, you've had several cities and counties in Colorado that have had their own laws. And these own laws, or these kind of city-specific laws or county-specific laws, will persist under the new statewide collective bargaining law. It'll be much like a California situation where the general law is meet and confer, but if the employer has, through the charter or code process, adopted a binding arbitration model, well, then they'll have to follow that local model, whatever it might be. And so it has been in Denver for many, many years. The city and county of Denver, it's a combined government, long ago adopted a charter calling for collective bargaining with employees, and the firefighters have been organized there. They've been organized as Local 858 of the IAFF. What created the present dispute is the unusual way that the collective bargaining ordinance in Denver is written. Rather than broadly say that the employer has to negotiate over wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment, which would be the common parlance for that, instead, the bargaining ordinance or bargaining charter provision in Denver lists the topics that are negotiable. And not on that list is the topic of discipline. There is sort of a catch-all working conditions piece to that list, but quite independently of whether discipline is negotiable, there's all sorts of other charter and code provisions that create a civil service system for the appeal of discipline. And this civil service system has coexisted with the bargaining process for many, many years. So what gave rise to this conflict? In 2010, the city attempted to change the charter's existing disciplinary system governing firefighter conduct. What it wanted to do was to rewrite its code of conduct and to create and implement a disciplinary matrix. The Firefighters Union, Local 858, sends off a demand to bargain to the city. The city says, nope, we don't have to bargain. It's not a mandatory subject of bargaining under the charter. And that is the dispute that winds up in the Colorado Supreme Court. And the Colorado Supreme Court sides with the city. The court says, look, you've got to consider the charter as a whole. And the charter as a whole creates this civil service system on one side, a civil service system that is devoted to hearing appeals for what is perceived to be improper discipline. And on the other side, the bargaining side, doesn't say anything specific about the issue of discipline. And the way the court said it was the topic of discipline is conspicuously absent from the listing of what is negotiable under the collective bargaining law, and without any express language bringing discipline into the ambit of collective bargaining, we will not infer that the discipline matrix is subject to bargaining merely because the phrase terms and conditions of employment is undefined and could conceivably encompass disciplinary rules. So in other words, that situation will continue into the future. Denver firefighters will continue to be covered by this, the charter provisions, the local charter provisions, not the new state law. It's a trade-off for the firefighters. Under the charter provision, if they don't reach an agreement in the bargaining process, they will have the right, the firefighters have the right to go to binding arbitration. If they were under the state law, they might be able to bargain about more things. They might be able to bargain about this disciplinary matrix, but in the end, because it's a meet and confer law, they wouldn't have the right to go to binding arbitration, and the employer could unilaterally impose its last best offer. So it's a push and a pull for the Denver firefighters, but the court's opinion is quite clear. discipline is not negotiable for Denver firefighters. An aside on this case, the big issue in this case is the whole question of a disciplinary matrix. And we get questions about these disciplinary matrices from time to time. And I've always been a little bit befuddled about these disciplinary matrices. I will say from an observational standpoint, we've seen them come and go. There's a big push for these matrices in the late 1980s, early 1990s. You saw them much more in law enforcement than you did in fire service. They seem to come out of Texas. I seem to remember the first one that had any great popularity came out of the Houston Police Department. And then they spread a bit, and they spread around the country. You saw some in California, various places around the country. And then in the last few years, we've seen employers start to get away from disciplinary matrices. And that's been kind of interesting to watch, because it was employers that pushed them, that wanted the matrices in the first place, and now it's employers who want to move away from the matrices. Why? Why this new attitude on the part of employers? They view a disciplinary matrix as hampering their discretion, as limiting their discretion. If something says, look, discipline is, you know, for this type of event, let's say it's off-duty driving while intoxicated, the range of punishment is 5 days off to 30 days off, you find fire chiefs, police chiefs wanting to say, hey, maybe 5 days to 30 days off is what I want, but maybe because of who this employee is, maybe I want something on either side of that. And with a disciplinary matrix, I can no longer do that. I no longer have that discretion. So we've seen this thing sort of wax and wane over the years. And it's interesting to see this Denver case where you have an employer that wants to impose a matrix at a time when other employers are wanting to get away from a matrix. Just kind of an observation, offhand observation about that particular case. Let's move to California while we're talking about discipline and an interesting issue that has come up that was decided by the California Court of Appeals a couple of weeks ago. And it deals with California's statewide Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights in California for many years covered law enforcement employees. Now it covers both firefighters and law enforcement employees. It is probably, from the employee standpoint, the strongest Bill of Rights in the country, strongest in the sense of the most procedural protections for employees. And a question that comes up from time to time is, can claims of a Bill of Rights, can those claims be arbitrated? Or rather, do disputes as to the Bill of Rights, do they have to go through the court system under the way that Bill of Rights is written? This particular case involves a captain who was working in the police department for the city of Santa Rosa, California. That's a beautiful city just north of San Francisco, kind of at the foot of the wine country, the Napa-Sonoma wine country. Mitchell, this captain, his name was Mitchell, was hired in 2005. He was hired apparently as a lateral. And beginning in 2007, officers started filing gender discrimination complaints against Mitchell and also against the police chief. An internal affairs investigation started, and it ended with the city deciding to terminate Mitchell's employment. A disciplinary hearing was scheduled. A due process hearing was scheduled. Mitchell, in the meantime, sues the city, saying, you're violating all sorts of my rights. The hearing goes ahead as planned, and the result is termination. And the city advises Mitchell he could challenge the termination either by requesting a full-fledged administrative hearing or by going through binding arbitration under his collective bargaining agreement. He decides to go to arbitration, and it's a three-person arbitration panel, and they rule for the city, finding that Mitchell was inappropriate and unprofessional with employees and dishonest during the IA investigation. The arbitrators noted that Mitchell had asserted that the city violated various provisions of the Bill of Rights Act, but the arbitrators didn't even address that claim, saying, look, the court system has exclusive jurisdiction over causes of action under the statewide Bill of Rights. And that's what gives rise to the Court of Appeals decision. And the question is, did the arbitrators make this fundamental mistake of law, saying that Bill of Rights issues are not subject to arbitration? And the court says the arbitrators clearly made a mistake in failing to resolve the Bill of Rights claims. The court system does not have exclusive jurisdiction over the Bill of Rights. An employee can make an assertion of the violation of Bill of Rights in arbitration, in court, or in administrative proceedings. And it doesn't matter. None of those forums has exclusive jurisdictions over Bill of Rights issues. The city said, look, you know, hey, no harm, no foul. This is a mistaken law that the arbitrators made. That's within their right. If there's binding arbitration, arbitrators can be mistaken as to the law and still have their opinions upheld. Court says there's a little bit of a difference here, because there's a distinction between making a mistake of the law during consideration of a contested issue and an error in failing to consider the issue in the first place. As the court says, arbitrators may decide a point incorrectly and have their opinions upheld, but they must decide the point. Did Mitchell win in the end? From Mitchell's standpoint, unfortunately, no. Why? Because he did later get a chance to litigate those Bill of Rights claims. He litigated them in court, in the trial court level. And so what Mitchell was really trying to do was to get a second forum, arbitration, to relitigate the Bill of Rights issues. And the court says, look, you only get one shot at this. You can't seek a new arbitration hearing to relitigate the Bill of Rights issue. Sure, the arbitrators were wrong in the first place in not considering your Bill of Rights claims, but given the fact that you subsequently had an opportunity to try to resolve those issues and the rulings were against you, we're not going to send this case back down to the arbitrators to reconsider the decision upholding your termination. The legal principle here, I think, is more important than Mitchell's case in particular. The legal principle is Bill of Rights claims in California can be subject to arbitration. The case I want to close with in this month's podcast also deals with a grievance procedure, but a different kind of issue: retirees and the grievance procedure. Can they file grievances, or are they not allowed to file grievances? This involves a fellow named Philip Buff, who was a firefighter who worked for the village of Manlius, New York. He became upset when the village stopped paying 80% of his post-retirement health insurance plan benefits. He said, look, you paid 80% while I was employed, and pursuant to the terms of the collective bargaining agreement between the village and village firefighters, I'm entitled to that 80% post-retirement. And so he brought a lawsuit seeking to force the city to provide the 80% in premiums. A trial court dismisses the lawsuit and says, look, you should have filed a grievance, Buff. You should have filed some sort of grievance under the collective bargaining agreement that covered you and taken that issue through to arbitration. Because the grievance procedure has exclusive jurisdiction over these sorts of contract claims, there's nothing for us to decide here in court. Buff says, wait a minute, how can I file a grievance? Under the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, the only people who could file grievances are the firefighters union and a member. That's the word that is used, a member. I'm not a member, I'm a retiree. How can I file a grievance? And the appellate court in New York agrees with Buff. The court says, look, we understand when an employer and a union enter into a collective bargaining agreement that creates a grievance procedure, employees can't sue. They have to go through the union in accordance with the contract. And there's really only two exceptions to this obligation to arbitrate contract claims. First of all, the contract doesn't allow grievances, then you could go to court. And secondly, if the union breaches its duty of fair representation, and that's what prevents you from using the grievance procedure, then you can go to court. And the court said here, it's the first of those two exceptions that applies. The contract doesn't allow retirees such as Buff to file a grievance. Here's the words of the court. The contract only allows the union or a member to file a grievance. Elsewhere in the contract, the word member is used interchangeably with the word employee. And several contract provisions that apply to members, such as holiday pay and annual physicals, clearly only affect active employees. Even if you look at the recognition clause in the contract, the court says, it says that the village recognizes the union as the representative for members with respect to salaries, wages, and terms and conditions of employees. Court ends up concluding, giving the word member its plain meaning, we agree with Buff. He wasn't a member of the union. Therefore, he couldn't file a grievance on this post-retirement health insurance issue. Therefore, he can sue the city in court. This Buff case is a reminder to us, you know, often when we are bargaining a contract, renegotiating a contract, we're probably not paying as much attention to a grievance procedure and the particular words at the grievance procedure as we should. Those words are incredibly powerful because they limit or define what is going to be subject to the grievance procedure. And remember, a contract, a collective bargaining agreement, is just another form of contract. Disputes as to the obligations and rights of the parties to a contract are resolved in court. It's only the grievance procedure in a collective bargaining agreement that takes those disputes out of court and funnels them through the arbitration process. It's the grievance procedure that gives us our alternative dispute resolution process of final and binding arbitration. So if you don't exclude something clearly from the grievance procedure, if you don't exclude it from the grievance procedure, it's going to be subject to arbitration. But if you do exclude it from the grievance procedure, then employees will be able to litigate over the underlying issue in court. And I've seen that misunderstood a number of times. Take a commonplace that's misunderstood. You may have a non-discrimination clause in your contract, a clause that says employer won't discriminate on the basis of race, gender, whatever the protected classes are that are listed. And at the end of that non-discrimination clause will say something like, disputes concerning the meaning and application of this clause are not subject to the grievance procedure. You also see that language in management rights clauses. Very, very commonly in a management rights clause in a contract, there'll be that tagline. Disputes concerning the meaning and application of this article are not subject to the grievance procedure. What does that mean? What that means is that disputes concerning those articles is subject to litigation in court. It doesn't mean the employer has complete discretion over those issues, complete discretion over management rights or whether or not an action falls within the management rights clause, or complete discretion in the area of discrimination. Doesn't mean that at all. That language, disputes aren't subject to the grievance procedure, just takes you out of the exception being that disputes would go to arbitration, and puts you in with the general rule, disputes go to court. And I really question how much it is to the benefit of either an employer or a labor organization to funnel any of these disputes into the court system as opposed to arbitration. particularly given how long it now takes to get cases through to the completion of litigation in court. Well, that's it for our April podcast. I want to remind you that at LRAS, we've got a couple of seminars that are coming up. We have a collective bargaining for public safety personnel conference coming up April 16th in Las Vegas. It's a 2.5-day seminar. We talk about bargaining topics and kind of bargaining in difficult economic times. And then we've got a seminar coming up in June 18th, also in Las Vegas. This one on the rights of law enforcement officers, the collective bargaining, the constitutional and statutory rights of law enforcement officers. I hope to see you at one of those conferences, and join us next May for our next First Thursday podcast. This has been Will Aitchison. Thanks.